Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Have you ever had a really great idea, done absolutely nothing with it, and then sat there in stunned disbelief when someone else comes along who's executed the idea and is now making millions of dollars? Well, I know I have, and I share that story in today's conversation with successful entrepreneur and author Trevor Blake. We share insights from Trevor's own In the Trenches experience, how to take your winning idea and launch a thriving startup. Let me tell you a little bit about my guest. Trevor Blake is the founder and served as CEO of three different medical technology companies, which he sold for over $300 million. He's the author of Three Simple Steps, and his latest book is a practical handbook based on his own experiences, business studies, and stories of other highly successful entrepreneurs. It's called Secrets to a Successful Startup, a recession-proof guide to starting, surviving, and thriving in your own venture. Here's my conversation with Trevor Blake. Well, first of all, I want to say welcome, Trevor Blake. Very pleased to have you with us today. And I really enjoyed your book a lot.
Thank you, Vicki. It's a pleasure to be on the show. I'm a big fan. It was a bit surreal to be a guest, actually.
And so I want to just dive into a little bit of your background, which is very interesting. The book is about how to conceive, plan, and launch your own business, one that's resilient enough to thrive in today's marketplace. And you write not from an academic point, but from experience, which of course is all important. And I know you've grown and sold several businesses over the years, Trevor, but at what point in life did you become an entrepreneur and why?
When I decided it was time to grow up, really, I think. The principles I use in my business are the same as I used in my life before I became an entrepreneur. So I grew up really poor in North Wales, and you know, my family never had a vacation. We never went abroad, and so I had this sort of strong motivation inside me. I wanted to travel. So for the first 40 years of my life, that was really my main motivation. And then, you know, a funny thing happens when you go to bed on the last night of your 39th birthday. You go to bed fit, and then you wake up 6 months pregnant. And so. So, you know, it's a little short, sharp shock, and I think, oh, I am getting old. I'd better do something about my financial future. So I'd been thinking about it for a while, and I knew I could. I just decided to start. So I was actually a late bloomer. I think I was 41 when I officially started my first company, and I'm currently on my fourth company. So I'm a kind of, I like to build, and then when the company gets too big for me to handle, then exit through a purchase or an acquisition. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're not talking about mom-and-pop type companies. I'm a great believer that people sell themselves too short when they're in business by themselves. I think it's just as easy to build a multi-million dollar enterprise as it is a $50,000 enterprise. It just takes the same effort. And so, you know, the combined value of the three exits I've had so far is about $350 million.
Right, right. Not to be sneezed at by any means. Tell us why you wanted to write this, because there are a lot of business books out there, but you were looking for something specific and then decided to write it.
Yeah, there really was nothing out there. I mean, there are hundreds of books by management consultants that can help you become a better manager. And if you want a regular career, then they're perfect for you. But when you know, most people, I've never met a successful entrepreneur who set out to be an entrepreneur. Everybody who's successful, and if I include myself, humbly include myself in that sort of category, you know, you set out to fix something that makes you mad or create something that doesn't exist, and you become entrepreneur by fault, if you like, or by default. And, you know, you're looking for, you know, some guidance, and there's really nothing for startups. If you go to a bookstore and browse, there's really very little. So I wrote it because it didn't exist, basically, and I wish this book had existed when I started in whatever it was, 2003.
Right.
It would have saved me a lot of painful mistakes, and that's sort of the foundation from which I wrote it. If you follow this practical guide, you know, you'll avoid becoming one of the negative statistics.
Yes, definitely. I'm a big believer in learning from other people's mistakes. Hopefully it can shortcut you a lot of agony. You say there's never a wrong time to start a business, and it's never too late to reinvent yourself, as you did. So let's just look at a few numbers that were kind of interesting. And these are from 2017. 80% of new entrepreneurs were over 40, 18% over 60, 40% of all companies owned by women, and 69% of all entrepreneurs start their business at home. I thought that was kind of interesting, especially the last one where almost 70% of entrepreneurs start their business at home.
Yeah, and that's, you know, starting at home, I think, is the obvious choice for most people, but that's really the key point in the success of a startup, because although a lot of people, most people start from home, they very quickly adopt all the things they've learned in the corporation or from observing the world, and they start to hire people very quickly. Then they go and find an office and they put a nice fancy sign up and they do all the traditional things that really don't work in this new age. We're in the early stage of a new industrial revolution where, you know, you can sit at your computer and you can engage the world in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fantastic opportunity. And that's why I think there's never been a better time to start your own company, because the old business model was to, you know, build a strong local clientele and then get referrals and then go regional. And then if you're really good, go national. Now you can go global on day one and you don't need to leave home anymore.
Right.
There's certain things you have to do and certain structures you have to put around your business in order to get through that very bumpy startup phase, which can, you know, usually last 6 months to 2 years.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the first secret to success, as you call it, and that you say is you. Mentality and approach, the way you think. Tell us what you mean by the global pioneering spirit.
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, this year alone, 300 million people will try to start their own company, and 300 million people around the world will go out of business. It's a heartbreaking statistic, and that's one of my passions and motivations, is to change that seesaw in favor of those who start a business so they can succeed. So the pioneering spirit has never gone away, although I don't watch the news particularly, but if you watch the news, you get the impression that, you know, there isn't any pioneering spirit anymore. But I see it everywhere mm-hmm. I go. You know, in America, 500,000 people every single month start their own company, and, you know, now they have a guide to help them do that, so I'm excited about that. But I'm also a great believer that in order to be successful, you have to prepare for success. You know, we read these stories of people who get overnight success, and, you know, it burns them out, and they get unhappy, and you often hear them say, "I wish I'd never won the lottery," and that type of thing. Well, I think in business, we live in an age where you can get big fast, and you can get financial independence at a speed that can pretty much blow you away these days. And so you have to be prepared for that. So it's very important to do some mental exercises, to do some mental training to put yourself in that position. And you have to do it right at the start, because it's also an era where it's no good being a Me Too company anymore. I work with China a lot, and they have three categories of investments. They have Me Too, Me Better, Me First. These days, you have to be a Me First. If you're a Me Too and Me Better, you're likely to be one of those negative statistics. And so right at the beginning, you've got to come up with a winning idea, not just an idea. And the winning idea typically is not something you love doing or something you're good at. It's typically something you want to fix or create. And so you have to go through that process first.
Right. And one of the things you say is that, you don't have to come up with a brand new idea. There are ideas out there everywhere. And part of this training, if you will, is to get you thinking and looking for that. And I actually love that you dedicate time to talking about this at the beginning of the book and again at the end of the book, because mindset is pretty much everything. And one of the things you talk about at the beginning of the book is connecting to nature, and not something you typically see in a business book. So tell us why you think that's so important that you put it in the book.
That's where the magic happens. I mean, if you were to pick, you know, a typical person who is a would-be entrepreneur, who wants to be an entrepreneur, and they're in the corporate world, they're probably working 8 or 9 or more hours a day. But, you know, statistics and surveys show that you're really only effective for about 2 hours and 53 minutes during a 9-hour day. You know, when you start your own company, burnout is a really big issue, because you come from a corporation or from a home situation where you're used to this power of work, this sort of crazy, crazy schedule. And you start to feel guilty very quickly when you realize how productive you are, and it's 10 o'clock in the morning and you've done all your day's work. And you sit at the computer and think, well, what am I going to do now? now. And I started out that way myself. I would sit at the computer and the phone on the desk, and I'd wait for the phone to ring or an email to come through the computer. And you can't be successful like that. So you have to structure your workday between dedicated work periods. This is my belief anyway. Dedicated work periods where you try to crack a nut, if you like, and then dedicated off work periods. And that's where the magic happens. That's where, when you get away from all of the electronics and you just take yourself for a little walk in the woods, that's where you get that incredible idea. And all my companies, I've had four, but I've had ideas for about 24. All of those ideas, those winning ideas, have popped into my head when I least expected and when I'm away from my desk. So it's a very deliberate process. It sounds a bit quirky and new agey to say, take a walk in nature, but by structuring your day between dedicated work periods and dedicated off work periods, that's where you get those incredible aha moments.
Yeah.
I do it, I've done it in the regular career as well, so I didn't just come up with this when I started my first company. I would go insane sitting in a meeting room with neon lights and plastic plants, and so I would always take my teams out and we'd go for a walk, and we solved every single, what we thought was an impossible problem to solve, we solved all of them just walking around the parking lot.
Yeah, I actually had a boss, my favorite boss ever, who would say, come walk with me, and we'd just go a walk. There was a river close to our office, and maybe two or three or four of us, we'd just walk and talk, and things. It's amazing what comes out when you're not in that enclosed environment.
Yeah, I think it's just you change your neural pathways and you become open to ideas, whereas when you're really focused and analyzing, you use different neural pathways and you miss all those opportunities and ideas. So it's just a case of it's important in your own business too, because the balance of life is really important to me. I know, some successful entrepreneurs who work 16 hours a day, but they're on their third marriage and the kids hate them.
Yeah.
And not the life that I would want for myself. I've been married 30 years and, when Lynn walks in the room, my heart still skips a beat.
Yeah, Lynn being your wife. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty awesome. Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
That balance is really important, and I think that's why you have to break up. When you work for yourself, you have to sort of break up your day a little bit like that so you get balance.
Yeah, one of the things I found interesting too, talking about your wife, Lynn, because you talked about how men typically make decisions from rules and regulations and past history, etc., projections. Women tend to be more intuitive, and you say there are often times when you mention something to your wife and she's like, oh, don't do it. And you've ignored her and now you listen to her.
I've ignored her twice in my life and it's cost me both financially and energetically. So, she says she's still training me, but I've learned my lesson. So, most women I've worked with have this, really sharp intuition, but of course the workplace tends to suppress that, or it doesn't, the typical traditional workplace doesn't really value the one person in the room who says, I know it makes sense, but it just doesn't feel right.
Right.
Most people just talk over that or ignore it. That's been the saviour in my business life, is that little gnawing feeling in the pit of my stomach. So for 30 years I've been working to improve my own intuition, and I'd say I'm better than most men that I meet, but I'm probably still only 10% of the average woman that I meet. But that's all I need to be successful. And it's not just me saying it. All of the surveys that are done show that women-led companies are 66% more profitable on average than men-led companies. And everybody says, well, why is that? And they come up with all these crazy psychological reasons. But I do think intuition has a really important part to play, because especially if you're starting your own company and you're going to hire, you're not going to hire employees. I recommend people don't hire employees straight away, because most people make that mistake, too many too soon, and you need to keep some cash dry. So there's other ways of doing it. So you're looking for vendors and consultants in the first place. Women's intuition, you can be sat across the table from the world's best vendor, but it just doesn't feel right. And you'll sit across the table from another vendor that everyone else is ignoring, and it just feels right. Those are the things that can, make a company.
Right. A couple more questions on mindset, and then we'll move on to something else. But one of the things you say, and you devote a whole chapter at the end of the book to really make sure we get this mentality approach in our mind. You say basically, in a nutshell, it's adapt or die. Just give us a little elaboration on that.
Well, we're seeing it right now in every high street or every shopping mall that you walk around, or every town centre, the number of closures and the number of companies that were staples not so long ago, things like Circuit City, Border Books, there's a whole list of them, massive companies that don't exist anymore. It seems impossible that they would ever be wiped out so quickly, but we live in this world where technology can put you out of business overnight. basically.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to adapt quickly. Well, if you build a company with a traditional hierarchical structure, by the time you get around to making a decision, it's too late. So I have a different structure for startup companies, and that structure allows you to be completely adaptable. And it's necessary to be that too, because I used to be lucky enough to work with George Rothman, who was the guy that built Amgen from virtually nothing to $60 billion. He was in his 70s when I met him.
Mm-hmm.
He used to say this to me. I used to wax lyrical about my next idea, and he'd hold up his hand and he'd say, "Trevor, just start. You don't know what you're in until you get in the business." And he's absolutely right, because you think you know what business you've started and what business you get in, and then the next day you find it's going in a different direction for good reasons. Maybe opportunities come your way or people point out different things, but you know, you can't premeditate what your business is going to be. So you basically have to jump in, and you have to have a business structure and a mentality that allows you to be completely adaptable.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at let's go back to timing a little, because I saw an interview, I saw a TED Talk, excuse me, the other day with Bill Gross, and he's a serial entrepreneur. He did his own study on what he thinks differentiates a successful company from one that fails. And he felt for sure the answer was going to be based around team and execution. But the strongest indicator of success in the companies that he reviewed was actually timing, and you know how relevant this was to what's going on now. And he named, you know, companies that had failed, such as Pets.com and Webvan, versus other companies that had really succeeded because timing was right for them. Net Zero and City Search were just a couple of those. So what do you think of his point of view on that?
I think he's right. I'm not sure that it's timing or it's matching of a winning idea to the needs of the time. And I agree totally with him. And it's no use today putting your hand up and say, "Look, I've just had an idea. I'd like to start my own company. I'm going to become a plumber." I mean, there's a lot out there, and it's, you know, that's not going to make you a multimillionaire quickly, and it's not going to give you an impactful company. And that word impactful is very important, because the companies that succeed are those that make a positive difference in people's lives. And what makes a positive difference changes over time.
Yeah.
You know, because we all have different needs and different desires, and technology allows us to, you know, suddenly think, "Oh, I didn't think I needed that, but now I need it," and then someone creates it, and off you go. So the thing about the time is that, you know, when you start your company, you don't have 20 years to build it anymore. I think people still sometimes think that way. I'll start a company and I'll do this for the next 20 years until I retire. It doesn't work like that anymore. You start a company and you do have to be successful quickly. And then you move on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. We live in a world like this, almost like there's no attention span. But I think that's the effects of technology. You know, I have an iPhone 5 and people laugh at it.
You're like me, mine's old too. It still works, it still serves its purpose. So let's talk about recession, because people say we're heading for a recession. I think you started three of your businesses during a recession, is that right? Am I right on that?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and so you have quite a healthy regard for a recession, so tell us about that.
I think it's all illusion, because economies go up and down just the same as everything else in the world. You know, we breathe in, we breathe out. I think there's been, if I'm correct, there's been 47 recessions in U.S. history since 1850. So they're a natural part of the sort of cleaning out the economy process. You know, all the companies that are poorly managed, that are working on tiny margins, they disappear during the recession, and other companies come in that are smarter, brighter, and you see your high streets or your shopping center change during those times. But I think that during a recession is a wonderful time to actually start a company, because of the availability of supply. You know, when it's a bullish market, and I experience this myself all the time, I'm experiencing it right now actually, in a bullish market, the vendors that you want don't have time for you. You're too small, you're not, you know, it's too much effort, we've got these big clients. And then the recession comes along, and the clients start to, you know, pull in the reins of their business. They don't, you know, they cancel production runs, they don't hold as much inventory and stuff like that. And suddenly those vendors turn to the small guy like me, and they say, "You know, when I ignored you and slammed the door in your face a couple of years ago, I'm sorry about that. You know, we'll make you a cup of tea and everything will be fine." So I find in recession that I get treated like a big company, and in bullish times, I tend to get ignored.
Right. So How do you know, how have you known with your businesses when you have an idea that excites you? Because you say you shouldn't really be starting a business if you're not super excited about this business.
Right, and it's got to be, if it's a winning idea, it's so exciting you can't sleep and you can't wait to start. And so you just start. And so I believe in, I call it reacting forward. There's so many great ideas that never go anywhere because people don't react forward and keep it alive. So there's certain things, tools and techniques that are in Secrets to a Successful Startup that you can just employ immediately, and you can turn a winning idea into a business without starting a business, just to give yourself time to hold on to that idea and let it grow in your mind and percolate. So there's certain tools and techniques I offer that help you react forward, and then lo and behold, before you know it, you're CEO of your own company and you've got customers.
Mm. Do you know the one that's always irritated me? Because for years I cut my the feet off my pantyhose if I wanted to wear them under pants and I wanted to wear open-toed shoes. And one day I hear about this girl, Sarah Blakely, who's, you know, making millions and millions of dollars. And I'm like, oh my God, she just cut the feet off pantyhose.
Exactly. She fixed something that made her mad. And it's a wonderful story. And, you know, she started her company secretly at home. She didn't even have a husband and family for quite some time because she was afraid they'd suppress it. And she reacted forward. And
yes.
Look where she is now. She's, you know, a fantastic company that also has a very ethical approach to the workplace and to impact in the world.
Yeah. And in your book, you talk about Richard Branson too. He says there's no point starting a business unless you do it out of a sense of frustration. So same kind of thinking there, really.
Yeah, you know, he's got wonderful stories too. The story of starting Virgin Airlines is one of my favorite, because there's no greater motivation for a man than to go off to a Caribbean island to see the girlfriend, the woman of his dreams. And his flight was cancelled. He was in Miami, I think. His flight was cancelled. So he charters a plane, and he runs up and down the airport selling seats because he can't really afford to charter the whole plane. And he actually makes a profit, and he gets to see his girlfriend. That was his total motivation, out of frustration.
Right.
And as the people are leaving the plane, in his biography, he says, someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know, you've got a pretty good airline here if you just smarten up your service a little bit. And he wouldn't have thought of doing an airline except for that one little tap on the shoulder and the experience of how easy it was to charter.
Right.
And then you get the Virgin brand out of that.
Right. And you've looked at some of these. Another one was Reed Hastings, who started Netflix because he was charged $40 in late fees when he returned his DVDs or videos back to Blockbuster. But you've looked at these and you say psychologists may be able to pull it together, but you hadn't really seen any outstanding commonalities in these people who took these ideas that were really quite simple and made them into multi-million dollar businesses.
Right, and I put myself in that category. I'm not a Richard Branson or a Jeff Bezos or anything like that, but I'm also totally unqualified for all the businesses that I've built, including my current one. I'm a sales and marketing guy, but I'm working on a cancer development company, and I, you know, without knowing anything about cancer development, but I'm smart enough to know how to get the right people around me and how to put the right business model together. All of that is included, you know, it's sort of discussed in the book a little bit.
Right.
It's very hard to find, you know, a lot of people I talk to who are somewhat, they want to start their own thing, but they're a little bit intimidated by it. And we have these conversations, and one of the common conversations is they seem to think that there's a secret school somewhere where someone's born an entrepreneur, or sorry, taught to be an entrepreneur, or someone's taught to be a CEO, and there isn't any such thing. We all learn on the job, kind of thing. And I struggled with that when I was in a regular career because I was intimidated by senior management when I first started, and I thought they had this, you know, cloud in the sky where they all hung out and bestowed their wisdom upon the world. And then when I got up to senior management, I realized that everyone was just making it up as they go along. And it's the same, and that's the fun part. That's the same in business. You make it up as you go along.
Right. Let's look at a couple of the most common mistakes. And you do talk about these in the book in more detail. But the most common mistake, and I think we hear this a lot, is that more than 80% of startup failures are largely because of cash flow management. So you talk about that in the book. What is the number one tip you'd like to give here on cash flow management?
Well, the world's changed and the game has changed, even while I've been building my company. So in the last 15 years, it's changed dramatically. Cash flow management, it catches everybody out. You know, just think, who would imagine Circuit City no longer exists?
Yeah.
They went out of business because of bad cash flow management. And they got a new CEO, and he basically ran the company into the ground because he didn't understand. You would think he would, but this goes back to what I'm saying. People really don't know what they're doing. They're making it up. He didn't understand the difference between having cash and having sales and cash flow management. And there's a huge difference. And it gets much harder in this current time because, let's say you start an online clothes retailer, if you like, an online clothes store. You know, I can go onto your website and I can order 10 shirts in different sizes and colors, and I can try them on at home and decide I only want to keep one and send 9 back, and you have to process that. So even managing inventory now requires extreme caution, extreme care, and so cash flow management is a real issue. And so in the books, Secrets to a Successful Startup, we discuss that, the difficulties of it, and the way that you can avoid it. It's really simple to avoid it, and it's heartbreaking that so many companies fail because they make the simple mistake of basically not having enough cash for the day that the supplier arrives and asks for his money.
Right, right. I'd like to get your perspective on sales and selling. Again, you talk about this in the book, but I think many people misunderstand selling, and it's such a critical skill to learn. It doesn't matter what you do, we do have to sell at every level and every job and every business. So where do people go wrong when they think about selling?
Well, they talk more than they listen, and that's in a nutshell for me. So for me, the biggest skill in selling is listening. And I learned that myself because I was working in a hospital, and a lot of pharmaceutical sales reps would try to impress me with their knowledge of their product and try to get me to recommend their product and that sort of thing. And I didn't rate any of them. Unfortunately, I also wasn't making any money in the hospital, and we were about to lose our house. We were late on the mortgage for a while. So I reluctantly decided to become a pharmaceutical sales rep. I told Lynn, oh, we'll just do it for 2 years, get ourselves back on our feet, and then I'll come back to the hospital. But I took to it like a duck takes to water, and I didn't expect to, because I couldn't sell a rope to a drowning man, you know? Mm-hmm. I really didn't understand what selling was about. I had the wrong impression because my father had taken a different approach to selling. He thought it was about getting away with what you can. I find with selling, it's really listening intently to your customer and then responding to the customer's needs. Even if you're not the one that can solve those needs, you still have to find a way to help them get what they want, even if it means, you know, pointing them in the direction of a competitor. So for me, that's all there is to selling. It's just listen really hard. But I'm always blown away when people send me their business plans and they haven't even left their desk and gone and talked to a potential customer. They haven't got any customer feedback. And I find that it's not that they don't want to. It's they're a little afraid of it, a little intimidated by the conversation process. They think the onus is on them to force something on a customer. And it's not like that at all. The onus is just to sit back and listen and then find a way to respond to it.
Yeah, interesting. In studies, a lot of studies look at what make people successful in ventures. Discipline and self-confidence are found to be much more important than intelligence to accomplishment. How do you define discipline? How do you define self-confidence?
Well, I don't think many people are born with strong discipline, self-discipline. I'm certainly not. I'm a very laid-back chap, and so I need all the structure around me. So discipline requires using tools and techniques that keep you structured in your workplace, and there's plenty of those in the book. Self-confidence is an interesting one because that's one of the reasons I wrote the book in the first place, because many people I talk to, the one thing that holds them back from starting their own venture, whether it's in commerce or arts or music or whatever it is, the same principles apply. They just lack confidence. And I understand all the reasons why people lack confidence, and so there's ways to put yourself in a position where you can build confidence, and the book is, you know, works its way through that. So by starting the right way, by having a strong idea that gets you jumping up and down, by doing the reacting forward, you as you're doing that, and then by going through the business plan process, it's a process, not a piece of paper. By going through that process, you build levels of confidence to the point where you forget that you used to lack self-confidence. And I agree totally. The one differentiating factor between successful entrepreneurs and those that aren't is definitely self-confidence.
Well, it's a book that's packed full of really great information. It's called Secrets to a Successful Startup, a recession-proof guide to starting, surviving, and thriving in your own venture. Trevor Blake, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Just start. There's never a
Just start. Just do it, right? That's what I mean. Yeah.
Right.
I really appreciate you being with us today. I appreciate your insights, and I know listeners can find out much more about you at your website, which is trevorgblake.com, trevorgblake.com. I want to thank everyone for being with us today. If you have questions, comments, or feedback on this segment, you can find me at conversationslive.net. We air a new podcast every Wednesday at the same address, conversationslive.net, and you can find more than 1,200 guest interviews, including today's conversation and Trevor Blake's guest information. Trevor Blake, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Vicky. That was a pleasure.
And we'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicky's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.